In case you were wondering, today's show is going to zero in a bit on England. We're going to be talking about English food on the show today. And if you're thinking plain and boring, well, you are wrong. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Our first guest today is Carol Wilson. She's a food writer and historian and a member of the Guild of Food Writers, author of a number of books, including Scottish Heritage Food and Cooking, The Licorice Cookbook, and The Bacon Cookbook. And her latest is titled Regional Cooking of England, A Culinary Tour. Dandy book. What would you like to know about English food and recipes? Have you had some experiences that you'd love to share, maybe when you were in England and dining there, or maybe trying to prepare some English food here? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Carol Wilson, welcome, and thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I really had a lot of fun with your book. You like to write about food, obviously.
I do.
Does that mean you like to cook, too?
I like to cook, and I like to eat.
What do you think food says about a country?
I think it says a lot about the history and the culture of that particular country. I think England has a very old tradition. I mean, we've got a lot of history. I think the first English cookbook was written around about 1390, which is a long time ago. It was called A Form of Curry, and curry was the old English word for cooking. And it had a lot of recipes in, some of which we'd recognise today, such as macaroni cheese, believe it or not.
From what year was that book?
1390.
Oh, so what did it look like? I bet it didn't look like your book. Your book is fantastic.
Well, no, it wouldn't have been a book. It would have just been written on sheets of parchment and in old English.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess one of the things I really enjoy about this book, and if those listening are, if you're thinking about traveling to England, or if you've been to England, boy, this is a wonderful book. And even if you haven't, it might inspire you to make the trip. I really enjoyed your history. Let's go to the 17th century. You write, that was a time of great change in English cooking. Maybe what are some of the biggest changes?
Yes, well, in the 17th century, things like tea and coffee were introduced to England. So that would be in the reign of Charles II. And chocolate, which was a very big thing, but probably not like the chocolate that we know today. It was a drinking chocolate and it was quite bitter. But chocolate houses and coffee houses were very popular in 17th century England. And Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist, mentioned several times that he was very fond of drinking chocolate. But of course, it was only for the wealthy. It wasn't for the ordinary people. They never got to taste tea, coffee or chocolate.
Yeah. How did tea become the drink of choice?
It was introduced into England by Queen Catherine, the wife of Charles II, and it was imported from China and India. And it became very fashionable because everybody, the wealthy people, wanted to copy the royal family. And so it began the tradition of drinking tea in the afternoon.
Mm. So what were the biggest influences on the English diet?
I think the introduction over the centuries of new foods from different countries, from India, from China, and from the New World. You know, we got potatoes, which are an English staple now, and tomatoes, pineapples, sugar became more widely available. The Crusaders first came across sugar when they were fighting in the Holy Land, and they didn't know what it was. They thought it was a reed that was filled with honey, and they brought them back with them. And sugar was extremely expensive, and it was regarded at that time as a spice, and it was kept in a locked cupboard with other spices. And so for a long time, it was only wealthy people that got to enjoy these types of food. But gradually, as time passed, with improved transport, these foods filtered down to the ordinary people, who tended to keep them for special occasions. Most people had a very plain diet, and things like dried fruit, sugar and spices were kept for special occasions. So that's why we have a heavily fruited cake at Christmas time and a simnel cake at Easter. And there were recipes in the book for those. They contain a lot of dried fruit, spices and sugar. And so we keep up the traditions from way back when, from before the Middle Ages. We still eat those foods.
Yeah, I was thinking as I was going through your cookbook, I came on the recipe for Cornish pasties.
And
It reminded me that England has, you may have gotten some items from the U.S., but you also passed along some great traditions from England to the United States, and especially to Wisconsin, because the lead miners in Mineral Point, I think that lead mining in which was in southwestern Wisconsin, lead mining became very popular, and it drew people from Cornwall in England because they were professional miners. And I'm pretty sure that those Cornish pasties, which are kind of a local thing, especially in southwestern Wisconsin, were probably brought, and I'm not a historian here, but I just guessed.
You're probably right. Yes, they would have brought their Cornish pasties with them.
I like them.
yeah, they're very tasty, yes.
Oh, man. Well, it's interesting to read about the history of products, and you mentioned some products. You didn't mention Worcestershire.
Worcestershire
sauce.
Yeah.
It's a funny word to say, but Worcestershire sauce, how they may have changed by, and even been changed by different cultures. Talk about that condiment for a minute.
Yeah, well, because England had a lot of colonial influence, the people who worked in the colonies, they brought some of the foods back. And for Worcester sauce, as we call it, we just call it Worcester sauce. We can still buy it here. It's very, very popular. We eat it with cold pies and all sorts of things. It was brought back, and it was mixed together. It's a secret recipe of spices and fruits and everything. And the people who made it thought, well, this doesn't taste very nice. So they just put it to one side and they left it. And because they left it for a long time, the actual ingredients matured and aged and they fermented, and it was a far better tasting sauce, and that's the sauce that we buy today.
Isn't that interesting? Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Has food in England become what's the right word, more homogenized in the last few decades, or is regional cooking still common?
Well, regional cooking is still common, and I think there's a renewed interest in cooking regional dishes, because nowadays we can buy food from all over the world. But those regional recipes are part of English history and culture, and we should preserve them. And they are still made, and they're only, some of them are only made in certain regions. For instance, Yorkshire curd tart, you can only buy in the county of Yorkshire. The rest of England, you wouldn't see that. Fidget pie in Shropshire, and scouse on Merseyside, which is a beef or lamb stew. But certain things like Eccles cakes and Chelsea buns and Cornish pasties have become available nationwide. So we have a wide choice of foods. Some of the old foods, some of the old traditional dishes have died out. Nobody makes them anymore. The recipes are lost. And I think it would be a shame if that happened to all the regional recipes that are in this book.
Yeah, which is one good reason why we have this book. I was thinking about my own time in England, a couple of trips. I went on our Wisconsin Public Radio sponsored a garden tour of England, and I looked at your map. You have the country sort of split up into six regions, and I have. This was 2012, so just 12, 14 years ago that I was there for that particular on that particular visit. But I managed, as I looked at the map, I thought, oh, well, I've been to four out of the six regions. And, in the travels on that tour, the food was quite, we had some quite different meals that were wonderful, but they were quite a bit different.
Yeah, well, yes. So those are the regional recipes that you'd have got. I don't know if you went to Yorkshire. I don't know if you tried any Yorkshire curd tart.
No, we were in the Northwest, Leeds, I think, Midlands. We were, I don't know, maybe Sheffield area. The eastern part, we were in maybe Norwich, and of course London in the southeast.
Yes. Well, London, they're very fond of jellied eels, which we never see in the north. Jellied eels is a very southern thing.
And what are they?
Well, they're eels.
Oh, jellied eels. I'm sorry. I misunderstood what you were saying. I thought it was some sort of jelly. Oh, jellied eels. We did not try jellied eels.
No, and what else do they have in London? Saveloys, which are a type of sausage, and that seems to be unique to the south around London. They have shops that sell those.
What? But, go ahead, sorry.
But in the north of England, we never see jellied eels.
Well, English food, now it had a bad rap. It's been called Blandenburg, and you even note that in the book at one point. And how did it get that label? Talk about that for a minute.
Well, I personally think it was the Victorians. I think they have a lot to answer for, because during the Victorian era, food generally was very plain and very dull, very brown and beige. And everything was cooked to death. I mean, Mrs. Beaton, in her famous cookbook, recommends boiling eggs for 20 minutes. Yeah. And cabbage was boiled for about 30 minutes in lots and lots of water. So it was practically tasteless by the time it was served. And I think that's such a shame. But we've come a long way since then.
You have indeed. Carol Wilson is our guest today. And she has this lovely book, a big book. It's over 600 pages. The title is Regional Cooking of England. And the subtitle, A Culinary Tour with More Than 280 Traditional Recipes. Questions, comments, experiences to share? Hope you joined in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas at WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, and Lee Rayburn, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Carol Wilson. Her book is titled Regional Cooking of England, subtitle A Culinary Tour with More Than 280 Traditional Recipes, filled with some wonderful recipes, some absolutely fantastic photography, and a great little history lesson for us in the book, which I found fascinating about food, the history of food in that country. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas at wpr.org. And Tom in Madison has a comment, I believe. Tom, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
And what have you got for us today?
Well, first of all, you have to know I'm 80, so I've been to England and the UK about 10 times since 1978. But just before I went to England in 1985, I read an article in the New York Times about Cockney cuisine. And one of the things I was talking about was jellied eel. And the best place to get it was at a walk-up stand on the East End called Tubby Isaac's. And every time I went to England after that, up until 2014, I think, I would always make a pilgrimage to Tubby Isaac's and have at least two or three bowls of jellied eel. And you just stand there and eat it. It's just a walk-up. And what's interesting is how many cars would drive up and stop and get their order and drive off. But unfortunately, before I went to England in 2014, it was announced that Tubby Isaac's was closing permanently. And I think your author probably knows this. One of the problems is there's a very big shortage of eel.
Oh, Tom, right. Thanks for calling. Comment, Carol.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I think eels... I think it's not something that young people nowadays really want to eat. And I think Tubby Isaac's, which is a very famous shop, I think it's a shame that it's closed. But I think you can still buy jellied eels in London. But perhaps there aren't as many jellied eel shops nowadays as there used to be. But I'm glad that you enjoyed them, Tom.
Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. I was just thinking about my daughter, Emily, who's majoring in marine biology, and she's one of her jobs at the college is to take care of the shark tank, the big shark tanks and all the other tanks. And one of her jobs has been to feed a baby eel with a forceps because the baby eel was kind of afraid, and so when she just dropped quill into the tanks, other fish had come along and grab it. So she had to have had to feed the baby eel with the forceps.
Oh gosh!
Just a little aside that has nothing to do with the rest of the show, but it popped into my head when Tom called about jellied eel. Tom, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Steve and Rhinelander is with us. Steve, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning. Tell me about English bangers.
Okay. What's an English banger?
An English banger is a sausage. And we're very fond of our sausages in England. We can buy all sorts of different flavors. They're made with pork or beef, even lamb or chicken now. But sausages have been a long-standing part of the diet in England. Sausages and mash, known as bangers and mash, are probably very popular. The reason they're called bangers is because earlier sausages, and even in the 1950s, just after the Second World War, sausages were made with quite cheap meat. And the casings were quite cheap. So when they were put in the frying pan, they used to burst and they used to go bang. So that was why they became known as bangers.
Oh, that's a great story. Steve, thanks a lot for calling. And, you know, Wisconsin, if you want to talk sausages, Wisconsin is, I think, has a worldwide reputation for its sausages. And when I sampled the sausages in England, I have to say the ones I sampled, I liked ours better.
Oh, that's very tactful.
Oh, well, you know, before we go too much further, tell us what readers of your cookbook are going to find between the covers.
Well, there's over 200 recipes for savory dishes, breakfast dishes, pies, which are very popular in England, and lots of puddings, desserts, sweets. We do have most people do have a sweet tooth, and we literally have hundreds and hundreds of recipes for puddings and desserts. In fact, even in 1698, a French visitor to England, François Misson, said, "Ah, what an excellent thing is an English pudding." So we were fond of our puddings even then. And Eliza Smith, who was a famous cookery writer, she wrote a book called The Complete Housewife in 1727. And it's got a huge number of recipes for puddings, boiled, baked, steamed, fried, iced puddings, jellies, trifles, all sorts of things. So we still eat those today, and we still enjoy our puddings.
I liked your puddings. I had puddings, I think, practically in every one of the regions that I was in at one point or another. You'd wind up with a pudding, and they were always good. Really yeah. good.
Did you have a favorite pudding, Larry?
The favorite pudding? Probably. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. It's 14 years ago. But I do remember. I remember really liking the puddings, but I couldn't put a name on any of them for you right off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. So what's that favorite pudding that you're talking about? You do have that in the cookbook.
Yes, at the moment, I think the favourite pudding in this country would be sticky toffee pudding. And that's not a very old recipe, actually. That came about, it was created either in the 1960s or the 70s, probably in the region of Cumbria here. And it's a dark pudding. It's made with dates and treacle. And it's served with a sticky toffee sauce, and it's usually served with cream or ice cream. So it's quite rich and sweet. That seems to be the nation's favourite pudding at the moment. But we have such a lot to choose from. There's Bakewell pudding from Derbyshire, which is maybe world famous now. And the old Bakewell pudding shop is still in the little town of Bakewell in Derbyshire, and it still sells little Bakewell puddings.
Oh, wonderful. Sorry. Tim in Hollandale. We'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
I married an English woman, so I go over occasionally. And HB sauce, why was it invented and what is it?
HB sauce.
Yes, HB sauce.
Right. HP sauce is a dark brown spicy sauce. It's kind of similar to Worcester sauce, but it's thicker. And we eat it with all sorts of things. We eat it with the English breakfast. We eat it with pies. We eat it with cold meats. It's dark and spicy. The actual recipe is a secret. But I don't know whether you like it. Do you?
You like it, Tim?
No, I absolutely was wondering, because we were eating breakfast and they were putting it on the breakfast, so I'm like,
"That's right,
yeah,
yes.
I'll give it a whirl." And why, you know, and I don't mind Worcestershire sauce, but yeah, that stuff was like, oof.
Right. It's very popular in England.
Oh, Tim, thanks for calling. By the way, you can join in too. Question or comment or an experience to share. We've heard some good ones here. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. I want you to talk about the history of calling a live animal a cow as an example, but when cooked, it's beef.
Oh, well, yes. yes. I suppose that's something that I hadn't thought of. Yeah, because there are two types of cattle that are reared. There's beef cattle, which are reared for their meat, and there are dairy cattle, which are just kept for their milk. So perhaps that's why we call those type of cows beef.
What did the Tudors bring to English cooking?
Tudors? Oh, no, let me think. Well, it was in the Tudor era that sugar became more plentiful. And so Elizabeth I had a well-known sweet tooth, and she loved things made of sugar. So the cooks at the court would create huge sculptures made of sugar, which would show off her wealth. But also, turkeys came to England in the Tudor era, in the reign of Henry VIII. I think they came from, I presume they came from America.
I would guess, yeah.
Yes. So Tudor England, and hops was another thing that came into Tudor England to make beer.
I'm trying to remember from, maybe it was from the book or maybe it was just out of my head from somewhere else, but they did not eat fresh fruits and vegetables or very much.
No, they were regarded as poisonous if they were eaten raw.
Oh, so, that's...
A lot of suspicion. So vegetables were always cooked at that time. But gradually, I think as people realised they weren't poisonous, they began to eat salads as well. So they did begin to eat them raw. So, yeah, it's all a matter of what people think about new foods when they come into the country, because when potatoes were introduced, somebody commented that they were related to deadly nightshade, so people wouldn't eat them for a long time.
Oh.
But now, of course, potatoes are a staple food here.
Absolutely. Roger in St. Charles, Illinois has something for us. Hi, Roger.
Hello.
Hello, Roger.
I was brought up in England. I was born just after the start of the war. So the first 30 years of my life was English cooking. And I never thought of it as boring at all. We used to have a rabbit stew probably a couple of times a month. We had a leg of lamb on a regular basis. And these certainly weren't cooked to destruction.
They were not. Well, no.
I think it was the Victorians who were very fond of cooking food for a long time. And gradually, as more was known about nutrition and vitamins, people realised things didn't have to be cooked for such a long time. And of course, England has got a variety of fantastic foods, beef and cheese, and all sorts of vegetables and fruits that we grow. And, of course, people used to grow food in their gardens. So they grow vegetables and they grow fruits. And they used to go out to forage in the hedgerows if they lived in the countryside and make a lot of jams and sauces. And so, no, I mean, English food has a very undeserved reputation for being bland and boring.
Roger, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Susie in Presque Isle, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I went to school in London in 1971 and fell in love with all English foods. I went up to Denbighdale in Yorkshire, and my foster family made fabulous trifles and custards. And I cannot make a custard here for the life of me. Is the milk different? I've even used the bird's custard that you can buy now in a lot of shops. It doesn't taste like the fabulous stuff in England.
Wow.
Right. Well, there is a recipe for custard sauce in the book. I know Bird's custard is very famous and it's ready made. But what didn't you like about the custard that you made yourself?
It just didn't taste as good. I'm also in adoration of Devonshire cream and scones, and the scones don't taste the same here. Americans make scones like, I don't know, rolls or something. They're not like English scones. What's the trick, do you think, for custard?
Well, basically, it's just eggs and milk.
Whole milk?
Whole milk, oh yes, whole milk and eggs and sugar, of course. And maybe the custard that you tried in London was maybe had some cream in it to make it more creamy?
I think so, and I'm just wondering if it's pasteurized versus unpasteurized milk. It's the quality of the milk is creamier in England somehow?
Ah, right. Well, we buy whole milk here. It's always pasteurized. But we can also buy something called Gold Top milk, which is from the Channel Islands, Jersey and Guernsey. And that is very, very creamy and very rich. So if you can't buy that there, what I would suggest is that you substitute some of the milk in your custard for single cream.
Oh, that might be worth a try. Susie, you should take a look at Carol's book, Regional Cooking of England, and we'll get yourself a copy and try the recipe that she has and go with the cream. my gosh. Barbara emailed to ask what's the to-do over mushy peas. When she went to London, they were on every menu. She ordered it very light green on the plate, but why mash them?
Right. Well, mushy peas are different from garden peas because they are made from dried peas that are soaked for a long time to soften them, and then they're boiled so that they turn into a mush. And originally they were a northern recipe, but now they're nationally popular. Usually them with fish and chips.
Well, fish and chips. If you came to Wisconsin, if you come and visit us in Wisconsin, you have to stop by and say hello, Carol. But if you came here to this state, you would soon find that every Friday there are fish fries in almost every restaurant, certainly every restaurant that I ever visit has a Friday night fish fry.
Oh. Friday was a traditional day to eat fish and chips here. But now, of course, you know, people buy them all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, we've eaten fish and chips in this country since about 1860, when the first fish and chip shop opened in London. And actually, Charles Dickens mentions fried fish sellers. They were among the street sellers of London, but they weren't. But the fried fish wasn't served with chips. It was served with bread. So if you were a street seller in London, you would sell a piece of bread with your fried fish. I think it's mentioned in Oliver Twist.
Matt in Alloway emailed a comment about some of the names of English food are very unappealing.
Oh!
Well, he mentions Toad in the Hole. He mentions Spotted Dick. He mentions Baby's Head Pudding.
Well, dick is the old English word for pudding. So, but nobody knows why, but that was an accepted term for pudding. So spotted dick is a steamed pudding, which is studded with dried fruits like currants and sultanas. I think you call sultanas white raisins. And toad in the hole. Well, that's sausages that's baked in a batter pudding.
And you've got a beautiful recipe for it in the book and a photo.
Yes.
I have to say that the photography, well, the writing is, you're really a good writer.
But oh, thank you.
But the photography is just outstanding, not only of the food, but of the English countryside.
Yes.
It's just a marvel.
I've done a great job, yes. It's lovely.
It absolutely is. And you know what? I'm looking at this book. It's a large book, kind of a heavy book, because you used the highest quality paper stock and very high, as I said, very high-end photography in the book. And I was really surprised how inexpensive this book is, given what a person has in front of them.
It's quite a heavy book, isn't it?
Yeah, I was, Lee Rabin and I were, you know, Lee thought maybe it was 8 pounds. I didn't put it on the scale, but it is, but it's also 650 or so pages.
Yes, yeah.
And it is a just a marvelous little history of the food of regional foods of England, with accompanying photography not only of the food itself but of the countryside. And it's just a lovely. It's the kind of book you're never going to let go of.
Yes, you'd be able to dip into it from time to time and hopefully try some of the recipes, at least, and find out about the history of them, where they came from, because there are so many English recipes which have often been handed down through generations for hundreds of years. And all the recipes are easy to follow, by the way, and you'll be able to achieve fantastic results in your home kitchen. You don't need any special equipment or anything.
Nor do you need a lot of, you know, special things that you might not find in your own pantry, to be honest.
Which I
liked a lot. And you take into account we Americans, too, in when it comes to amounts and so forth. It's there's kind of both the British and the American way of saying certain things.
Yes. Yeah.
It has been delightful talking with you, Carol. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and certainly for putting this book together. It's a classic. Thank you very much for being with us.
Really, thank you for talking to me.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you, Carol.
Thanks.
Carol Wilson, the author, and the book Regional Cooking of England, subtitled A Culinary Tour, with more than 280 traditional recipes. And they are easy to follow recipes. And, you know, it's called A Culinary Tour. And speaking of tours, if you can read her book and get the tour that way, or maybe you want to do a culinary tour and actually go and visit the place, the UK, and not only England, but Scotland. And I'll be going to Scotland in the fall. I'm looking forward to that. Northern Ireland. I tell you what, our next guest today knows a whole lot about culinary tours and tours in general. Carrie Mulliken, our guest, from back with us from Bon Voyage World Travel Experts. Our next guest, stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I just, this just in, I'm learning that we're close to meeting our $30,000 World Press Freedom Day match. We're celebrating World Press Freedom Day, which is Friday, but we're celebrating it and recognizing it. And we have a little goal of our own here. We have that goal of $30,000 by tomorrow. And you can reaffirm your commitment to trustworthy journalism if you go to WPR.org/donate or 888-202-2552. Use that number, give a call, and let's go over that $700 during this show. I would like to be able to do that. And I'm really glad to be able to talk to Carrie Milliken again. And where, you know, if you're planning a trip to England or Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland, you have a lot of options to learn about the food of the region. And we're going to be taking a look with Carrie about culinary tours. And she is president, by the way, of Bon Voyage World Travel Experts with offices in Waterford and Union Grove. And just to let you know, Carrie helped myself and four of us to get our passage to Scotland. That's coming up in September, and she did a bang-up job with that. Carrie, thank you for joining in today.
Hello, Larry. Nice to be here again. Nice to chat with you.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you. And if you'd like to talk to Carrie, you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So the title of the book that we just talked with the author about, the subtitle is A Culinary Tour with More Than 280 Traditional Recipes. Well, that's the book. What's a culinary tour in your mind?
Gosh, there's so many different ways to explore food while you're traveling, especially internationally. There's some excellent tours that have become available, and I would love to share more about those with all the listeners today.
Yeah. How is it different from, I mean, there are cooking vacations, but a culinary tour is a little, or would you define that differently?
So there's a lot of different ways in which you can explore local cuisine in an area. I mean, things like you could do a tour where you're dining in someone's local home and being a part of local culture. You can do things like tours. So maybe you arrive and you've got a couple of days in a specific city, not just in the UK, but around the world, where you could spend some time incorporating maybe a bike with a food tour, or an afternoon walking tour with maybe some afternoon tea and some tasty treats. A variety of ways.
How do you find a good tour?
How do you find a good tour? Personally, I like to work with small group tours or something that's private. Sometimes it is nice that when you're doing, you know, a tour that surrounds food, to have some other camaraderie. So I love small groups because you can travel easily from place to place, and you get to, you know, talk and chat with some of the other participants in the tour.
Do culinary tours, do they tend to be more expensive because of the food involved?
Not necessarily. I mean, depending on where you go, if we were to use London as an example, just because many travelers are interested in London, it's on their bucket list. You can do a local flavoring from, you know, $99 all the way up to something that maybe would be more private, where it might be a little bit more expensive than that. But there's a lot of different price opportunities in both, you know, a European market, as well as if you're traveling in the United States to the South or something.
Yeah. Dwayne in Westfield has a comment for us, I believe. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, how you doing? My family's from England. My sister's still living there. But if you really want to go on any tours that were really good for culinary stuff, between bakery or anything else, I would suggest going south, or the south of the country, like in Cork and a few other places around there. There's several people that are from the actual Great British Baking Show that live over there, that actually have their own bakeries and stuff and do show up there. So it would be kind of a nice little treat for them to actually go down there and learn how to do some of that stuff on their own.
Yeah, Duane, thanks a lot for calling. Comment, Carrie.
I would agree with that. Absolutely. I think the difference is you can either rent a car or do local transportation to get to a destination such as what he's speaking of. Or what's nice about some of these tours is you're meeting up with others that maybe it includes transportation or a guide where they're taking you from point A to point B where you don't necessarily have to navigate that.
Did you? I'm just wondering from your perspective, and I'm sure you've arranged a number of culinary tours. Did the Great British Baking Show, has that had an impact, perhaps, as, you know, Duane was is referring to here?
Absolutely. I think all of these baking shows and cooking shows that have come to, kind of be ways of us entertaining have definitely brought, and I've seen an increase in food tasting or cooking demonstrations as a result of that. So absolutely.
Oh, interesting. Duane, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. So the locations of these tours, you did mention that you can do some private things. Are they mostly restaurants where they occur?
Not necessarily. I mean, they might be on a riverboat as you're sailing a canal or a river in Amsterdam, as an example. So there's a variety of ways you can do them. Like I said, you can sometimes, do one that maybe has activity involved with it. You know, certainly when you're doing a food tour, you tend to be eating a few calories. So it's nice to do maybe even a biking when we're biking between the different destinations.
Yeah, I like that idea. What are your thoughts on adding a culinary tour to maybe an already planned vacation?
I think it's a great idea. It's an excellent way to experience local flavor, and you can do it in as little as 2-2.5 hours, so it doesn't have to take up an entire day if your schedule doesn't allow for it. And the other interesting thing about a lot of these tours now is they're really catering to certain allergies. So it used to be I happen to be gluten-free, and it used to be that when, years ago I could go on a tour, but maybe I couldn't, dine and eat everything that everybody else was, and now that's really changing. So there's a lot of allergy-safe culinary experiences that are now out there.
Oh, so you can just pick one for the allergy that you might have.
Exactly.
To avoid it. Oh, my gosh. Well, I wanted to mention drink tours. I'll be in Scotland, for example, where I'm imagining there are some tours of Scotch whiskey. But what about, just in general, what about drink tours? How do they work?
Well, in the area that we're talking about today in the UK, certainly in Northern Ireland and Scotland, pubs are really, really popular. So everybody likes to just enjoy the camaraderie that comes with a pub with some live music. And so the small pub tours are certainly a great way to experience, again, local culture, maybe taste the local beers in the market. So certainly I would definitely suggest doing one.
And English food, do the tours of the UK usually feature regional? I mean, the book that we were talking about was regional cooking in England. Are the regional foods usually what's featured?
Sometimes, keeping in mind that, big cities such as that have different boroughs or areas, so there might be a Indian, area that you could go to or like a little Italy you could go to. So not only do some feature the local cuisine for sure and local flavor, but also, different culinary types of food within that area in a smaller, town or city, so to speak, or section of the big city.
Yeah, that makes sense. What are some of the more popular food tours in Britain?
It's funny being in Wisconsin here. I know in London they have a cheese crawl, and I think, that's just unique to go to London and have a cheese crawl because we're so fond of our cheese here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I like that, and there are some pretty good cheeses over there, too.
You mentioned earlier, fish and chips and the popularity of that. I know that one of the tours is a Westminster Abbey tour where you view the changing of the guards and that it's incorporated in also with a food tour where you could taste some fish. And that, again, even a full day, you're looking at maybe 7 hours. Maybe it includes some lunch, some walking, maybe even a dinner, depending on the tour.
Yeah, it's do you have a favorite kind of food tour in the U.K.?
Boy, that's a tough question. you know, I tend to gravitate towards some fun desserts sometimes, you know, things that we don't necessarily get locally at home. So a authentic British food tour that would incorporate some sort of dessert is always fun.
Okay. Carrie Mulliken, our guest today, president of Bon Voyage World Travel Experts, offices in Waterford and Union Grove. And we're talking about culinary tours. You may have a question. And I, you know, you if you want to stray away from the UK, I know Carrie can help with that too, as we talk tours. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. We will take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Carrie. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. You know, one way to get to know the food of another country is to take a culinary tour. And on the show today, we've been talking with an expert about what you need to know before you go. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR. Back with us, Carrie Mulliken is president of Bon Voyage World Travel Experts with offices in Waterford and Union Grove. So as we talk with her about tours or travel in general, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Carrie, we got an email from Trista to ask if you are familiar with James Herriot's Yorkshire. And could you talk about that destination?
Boy, I don't know a lot personally about that. Certainly, you know, the world's a big place, and it's hard for us to personally experience every corner of the world. But certainly, we can do the research, and we can talk with other members of our team that perhaps have been there. If she wanted to reach out to me directly, I would be happy to comment and help answer her questions.
Janice emailed us. She's looking for a different kind of a tour of Australia. And the details mention what is called a trip kitty, and a trip kitty may be applicable. What is this, and why is it added to the price of the tour later, making it hard to figure the total cost of a trip?
That's certainly disturbing, and I can understand where her concern would be. Not knowing that specific tour, it would be tough to comment in terms of what exactly that is. But again, if she wanted to reach out, I could try to explore that with her. Perhaps it's something where, you know, when they're in a particular city or town, that they have the ability to use those funds towards a meal or something would maybe make some sense. Or maybe it's a, you know, package or something that's mailed to her prior to her departure that makes some of the travel experience a little bit more pleasurable, with maybe a you know, eye mask or something like that for the plane, are only the two things that would come to mind at the moment.
Yeah. She wonders, also relating to a trip to Australia, is $1,000 more for a premium economy seat over an economy worth the extra money? People have said that when the seat in front of you reclines, you lose a lot of your space. So apparently there was a $1,000 more for a premium economy seat over an economy seat.
So certainly it's important to always stay, you know, within a budget so that the experience is pleasurable, not only during the trip, but also when you get the credit card bill at the end of the trip. However, each aircraft is designed differently. Some have what they call a premium economy, which is just like an economy plus that's still in the economy class, but gives you maybe 4 to 6 inches more leg room. And then some aircraft or airlines have a true premium section. If you are upgrading from economy coach to premium and going to Australia round trip for $1,000, I would definitely take that offer if it was me personally.
Okay. What advice do you have for traveling to the UK? maybe money would be one. What should you know about money in the UK?
Sure. I think, you know, certainly money is important. You want to make sure that you have that currency or the ability to get the currency when you're there. But I think more importantly, what I'd like to just share in case, you know, listeners are not aware, is if you are looking at going to many countries in 2025 outside of the United States, you know, that e-visa is going to go into effect the mid part of 2025. So, again, nothing to be intimidated about. But if you're kind of a DIY, you know, make your own plans, it might not be something that everyone is aware of and should definitely look into.
What is it again? I missed that.
Sure. So it would be the electronic visa for the European Union. So a lot of countries, if you're leaving the United States in mid-2025, you'll be required to obtain an e-visa.
E-visas. Okay.
Which is not something, you know, typically we think of certain countries where you have to go through the visa process, like China or something, and, you know, it's quite a lengthy process. This isn't going to be quite that, but it is something that's going to be required.
And that's for 2025?
Correct. Mid-2025, we expect it to roll out. I think they're still defining a few details about it. We expect it to be about €7 or so per person, and it will be an online link that you will want to register for, again, probably 48 to 72 hours prior. As we get close to the launch date, I'm sure some of that will be defined a little bit more, but it is something to keep at front of mind.
So you don't have to, you already have, let's say you have your visa, which you'd need anyway, I would think. But you need this, it's probably whatever airline you're going to be on or working with a travel agent, they're going to be up on this.
Absolutely. The passport is what you need to have to get into the country for sure, to leave the United States. So that would be your passport book. But the e-visa will be in addition to the passport book.
Okay. And that needs to be done. I think I had to do something extra last year when I went to Canada as well. And I can't remember if they called it. It wasn't an e-visa, but something that I needed to have. And I can't remember what it was, but I had to do it. I had to work through the Canada in order to get qualified to and have that ready online in my phone when we went there.
There's a lot of countries that require some sort of entry document, so that's important to really do your research or work with a trusted travel advisor. I think we've, you know, referenced that in the past, so that, because often on the airline's website they may or may not tell you about it, or maybe it's in small print and you don't necessarily know what it is or read it. So it is important, especially when going outside of the United States, to really either do your research or work with someone that can do that for you.
Do you book travels, tours and so forth at all times of the year in the UK? What's the best time to visit probably?
Absolutely, we do. And the best time really kind of depends on your personal preference. You know, weather often plays a factor, but these days, especially after COVID, crowds play a factor. So at a time when we used to see a lot of travel happening in our summer months because of weather there, really, you know, we see some of that kind of shadow off a little bit to the shoulder season for those that want to avoid, you know, the massive amounts of crowds in different destinations.
And so maybe even for health. Oh, and for I would say price, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a beautiful time to travel. I just returned in March with a very large group in Ireland. We went to Dublin to see the St. Patrick's Day parade, which was quite the experience. And we had wonderful weather. I mean, there was a day or two that might have sprinkled a little bit, but overall, no coats we were wearing on St. Patrick's Day and really was able to enjoy. And that would have been, you know, in March.
So some countries now have a fee when entering them. What the heck's that about?
So the airline tickets often will include all your taxes and fees, but there are exceptions to that. So again, it varies all the time. You know, the one thing that's constant about travel is it will always change. So what was current, what you did last year when you went pre-COVID, is likely going to be different when you return to a same destination.
Mm-hmm. And since we've zeroed in a little on Britain today, do they have a fee, by the way?
There's not a fee that I'm aware of that we charge outside of what would be taxes and fees with the airline. But like I said, come mid-25, the e-visa would play a factor in that.
Yeah. The cost of for global entry is increasing. First, maybe explain what global entry is.
Sure. So global entry is good. People often get confused between the different options out there today. So there's CLEAR, there's TSA PreCheck, and there's global entry. If you like the idea of, you know, getting a TSA pre-clearance and you travel internationally, my recommendation is to just, in the beginning, go ahead and do the global entry. You might want to check with your credit card company because often certain credit cards will give you a stipend that you can put towards a TSA PreCheck or global entry. And what global entry does is helps clear you. So you're back in the, you know, years ago, you'd sit down, you'd fill out that form that they would pass out to you on the plane, the immigrations form, and you would take that when you come into the United States and go through immigrations and customs. This is an electronic version of this. And I do travel internationally quite a bit myself, and typically I can get from off the plane, and the longest part of Chicago O'Hare is the walk from the plane to that checkpoint. But literally, I can get through that checkpoint with global entry in a matter of minutes.
Oh. So what if you already have the TSA PreCheck, which I have, but I don't have the global entry. Is there a difficulty getting the global entry, or does that make it easier because you already have the TSA?
It probably makes the process a little easier. You know, years ago when it first came out, rolled out, you had to go meet in person and there were only specific offices. Now they've rolled that out to major airports. So if you do the paperwork online, you can usually get your in-person interview at a major airport. Maybe you're flying and you're connecting through Dallas or Miami or something of that nature, and you're able to do the in-person appointment at that time. But really, TSA, the things to know about that is not every airline accepts TSA, first of all. But ideally, the TSA PreCheck is going to allow you to get through that special line at the airport when you're getting ready to depart on your trip in the United States, so where you're not having to remove your shoes or your, you know, maybe your laptop from your computer case or your jacket. And it's a much simpler process. Global entry doesn't help you in that scenario. Global entry is really for returning back to the United States.
Uh-huh. And the cost of that, it's going up.
Yeah, I don't recall the current cost on it because we typically provide the link and then everybody just submits. And I did mine probably 3 years ago. I believe they're valid for about 6 years.
Yeah, I think they're around $120, if I'm not mistaken.
That sounds correct.
That sounds about right. When you plan a vacation for a client, how do you determine what should be on their itinerary?
We really do a great, conversation about what's important to them, because what matters most, you know, often people think, well, I want to go on a vacation, I want to spend this amount of money, and they go into a vacation based on the dollar. What I try to focus on is when you come back from this vacation, is it going to be everything that you wanted? And that includes a budget. So we really do an excellent job of just having a great conversation. What's important to you? What did you like before? What amenities are of interest? Do you want to be within walking distance? We would maybe establish that they're a foodie. You know, what better way to go and incorporate sightseeing where maybe you're kind of going off the beaten track instead of a major road, you're going, you know, off that road to, you know, iconic pubs that would be easy to miss if you weren't with someone. And then feeling like a local in another country and being able to say, hey, I was a foodie in the UK. How fun is that?
It sounds like a lot of fun to me. Oh, my goodness. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And just joining us now is Patrick from Stoughton. Patrick, what is on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to let you know that if you do global entry, it includes TSA pre.
Yes. So
absolutely. So that's why I mentioned earlier, if you are planning to travel internationally, don't just start with the TSA PreCheck. Get the global entry so that it includes that as well. Excellent point, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. Appreciate it. And you can join in too, 800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you. I'm thinking about vacationers. Do vacationers tend to overbook their trip with too much to do and see?
certainly. Absolutely. We have that conversation often where you just want to be able to have a little bit of downtime to immerse in the area. You know, maybe go for a walk in a park or take in a picnic lunch at a park and just really just experience your surroundings and immerse yourself. So definitely something that we talk about when planning a trip.
Yeah, I was thinking about my trip to Scotland. You know, there's a lot of golf involved, but we did schedule kind of a day right in the middle of the trip, at least one day, maybe there were two. Anyway, right in the middle, after a couple of days in a row of golf, we got a day off.
You'll be pleased with that decision, I think. Absolutely.
Yeah, and we'll be able to do a little. Actually, we'll be moving to different areas to play golf. So along the way that day, we can take a nice leisurely drive, take up the day, stop at various points. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun, to be perfectly honest. But to have that day in the middle, you're walking, you know, a long way and pushing a bag around, 40-pound bag around for 4 or 5 hours. It's nice to have a little break in the day, at least at my age. I might have been able to do anyone. yeah, for sure, because you're losing. You know, that first day there, our first day there, by the way, is more or less a rest day once we get there, but just stay awake and we've got some activities and things to do to sort of get warmed up and into the action. Our tourists, you know, let's say you're going to a country for the first time. Are tours a better idea or a good idea when traveling for the first time?
I think they are. And, you know, there's different options for different, personalities and things that you're interested in. One option that tends to be fairly low cost that, you know, tourists can start with would be like a hop-on, hop-off type tour where you have, you know, maybe 8 or 10 stops and there's a map with different activities or tourist spots within that area, and you go to that destination, hop off the bus, there's narration as you go, and you see the things that are at that stop, you get back on the bus, you go to the next. But what's nice about that is you can do it on your timeline, where when you're with a formal tour, it might be that, you know, here we're going to stop, but you're only going to have 90 minutes to walk around or 15 minutes to explore. So there's a couple different ways in which someone can tour, and that's something, again, that we would do an evaluation process. But yes, I do recommend that because it gives you your bearings, and then it allows you to be a little bit more comfortable when you're exploring those following days.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because there would be people that say, okay, I have 90 minutes is going to be good enough for me. But others might say, you know, at a particular spot, but others might say, oh, I want to spend more time.
What's nice about that, too, is, as you mentioned earlier, you know, when you're traveling to the UK, typically from the United States, Wisconsin area, you're going to travel throughout the night and you're going to arrive the next morning or, you know, early afternoon. And you want to be able to try to get used to that difference in time zone. So to do a tour like a hop-on, hop-off gives you flexibility to do it at any time. There's not a hard start time. So it allows you to just see the sights, you know, relax a little bit, have something to eat, but not you know, to be able to spend that afternoon so that you can get a good night's rest and then wake up refreshed and ready to go start exploring for the rest of your trip.
Yeah, I was glad. In my case, I was glad you found a direct flight for us. So you get on, there's no changing of planes, and you just go right straight there. That to me is.
I still recommend that today. The airlines have staffing issues like most businesses do today. So whenever you can try to fly nonstop, I do still recommend that.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you on that. Well, give me an example of a tour that you've done recently that's turned out really well. I imagine they mostly all turn out well, but.
Well, taking 169 people to Ireland for St. Patrick's Day was phenomenal. Everybody had a fabulous, fabulous time and came back, you know, wanting to plan their next adventure. But kind of talking a little bit more about, you know, you had asked a little bit earlier about, you know, like a pub tour or something. So to just give your listeners you know, kind of an overview of what some of those highlights would be. Again, you would walk to maybe four different pubs. They're really off the beaten track, so ones that you might have missed on your own. Maybe enjoy a bite to eat and the drink of that area or something that they're known for. That might even include, you know, a fun little afternoon of playing a game in an Irish pub or an English pub, excuse me. And then, like I said, talking with others, maybe listening to some live music. And something like that would run about $88 per person and would be about 3.5 hours. So, again, not super expensive, doesn't require a lot of time, but be able to see and do and feel like a local.
Yeah, that's do you ever give suggestions on dress or attire and that sort of thing as well?
Absolutely. You know, especially when touring into some of the churches or cathedrals, there's certainly dress attire for women with not having bare shoulders, or sometimes it's a foot attire that's required. So it just depends on the tour. And that's what's important. In travel, you don't know what you don't know. So you either have to do a lot of research or you have to work with trusted travel advisors.
Yeah. I can remember going into a restaurant. I had a brand new pair of tennis shoes on. And I was refused service because I was wearing tennis shoes. And I looked at some of the other people that were there, and some of them had some really ratty old sandals that looked awful. And I couldn't figure out why I was being told I couldn't eat because I had nice tennis shoes on while others could have. But that's, you know, that's a custom. I didn't know. I learned from that. And kind of learn the hard way. So it's better, I think, to get that advice ahead of time and know that when you're going somewhere. Well, Carrie,
absolutely. There's so much to know.
Yeah, there's a lot to know. Well, Carrie, I want to thank you again for being with us today. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Where's your next trip?
I'm headed to Mexico to a couple new resorts that have opened up to explore those and see what those are like for our clients. So I'll be off to Mexico in May.
Well, you have a great trip, and thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it very much, Carrie.
You enjoy Scotland.
Okay, Carrie Mulliken, president of Bon Voyage World Travel Experts. Carrie has offices in both Waterford and Union Grove, Wisconsin. It's always fun to talk with her. And probably get her back to do this again. Well, tomorrow on the show, Lisa Johnson's back to talk about attracting pollinators to the garden. I'm looking now to see if we've reached our goal of matching goal. We were close. I think we had about $600 to go to. There's a matching group of donors, generous donors, who have put up $30,000, and you can get your gift matched right now. Double your gift at WPR.org/donate or phone 888-202-2552 and make your contribution. Help support Wisconsin Public Radio and World Press Freedom Day. Tomorrow, Lisa Johnson is back for Garden Talk to visit about attracting pollinators to your garden and answering all your garden questions. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.